again.
This is Rebecca Naldo, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading for Are We There Yet? A quirky travel guide to the Southwest and beyond. How this experimental village in the Arizona desert tried to propose an alternative to urban living, by Eugene Shin, published September 12, 2024. Inside a unique experimental eco-village built into Arizona's Sonoran Desert. Listener discretion, this story contains references to rape and child abuse. In spring, Arizona begins to bake. In the hot, desolate Sonoran Desert, the midday sun inches the temperature past 100 degrees Fahrenheit, which makes any walking unpleasant. But the hot, sprawling desert landscape is not meant for walking. The beauty of the open horizon is better appreciated inside an air-conditioned vehicle, or, if you're a certain type of traveler, on horseback. The wind, organic or inorganic, distracts from the intensity of the heat and allows you to notice the particular beauty of the brown rolling hills and the desert life that dots them, including the majestic saguaro cacti. From Phoenix, I traversed the desert northward for just over an hour to reach Arco Santi, a live-and-work compound that touts itself as an urban laboratory. It is the brainchild of Paolo Soleri, an Italian-American architect and urban planner who put forth the idea of arcology, a portmanteau of architecture and ecology that is embodied in the creation of a city that exists in balance with the surrounding environment. In theory, this was a compact, densely populated, and self-sufficient micro-city with all necessary amenities of life within building parameters, including systems of food production, waste recycling, entertainment, schooling, and commercial enterprises. Soleri sought to bring this theory to life in the Arizona high desert, beginning completely from scratch on an empty plot of land, relying on the building hands of students and volunteers whose numbers reached thousands since its beginning in 1970. Paolo Soleri was born in Turin, Italy, in 1919. As a young man in Mussolini's Italy, he considered the United States the land where dreams were made and secured his ticket overseas by committing to a fellowship with Frank Lloyd Wright, a man whose stylistic influences reverberate through modernist architecture, and more specifically in Scottsdale, where he kept his living and working compound, Taliesin West. Wright and Soleri didn't particularly get along, and Soleri was asked to leave Taliesin West in 1949. Following his leave, Soleri completed a commission, got married, and returned to Italy, where he became a ceramicist and designed a ceramics factory. With that money, the family returned to Arizona, where he drew up a plan for his own living and working compound in Paradise Valley that he named Cosanti. This was 1956. Cosa, in Italian, means thing, and anti means against or before. And per its name, the Cosanti compound served as a place where people were meant to live and work together with minimal draws of the material world. Soleri was highly critical of post-war consumerism and urban sprawl, with its large single-family suburban habitats and dependence on automobiles. The storage of people in planned communities, generous in space, deprived of humanness, does not qualify as architecture, Soleri told Lisa McCullough in 2011. They belong to devolution, a storaging. Soleri also believed that the effects of suburbia were not only social, but environmental. In his notebook, which he kept daily, he wrote that the metastasis of the city created a culture characterized by isolation, logistical crippling, land destruction, soil decay, aquifer degradation, quarantine of forests, pollution, and inevitably materialism, a biblical-scale catastrophe. Instead, he thought humans should build up and more densely to minimize their impact on the surrounding environment. It certainly isn't difficult to imagine what he would have thought of Paradise Valley today as Phoenix's wealthiest suburb, full of luxurious, sprawling villas with manicured lawns, multi-vehicle garages, and crisp, unspoiled views of the Camelback and McDowell Mountains. By the 1960s, Kosanti drew hundreds of students and volunteers who were enraptured by the idea of building, living in, and working from a sustainable desert dwelling. Towards the end of the decade, Solari decided that it was time for him to execute his ideas on a bigger scale, and in 1970 traveled 70 miles north from Paradise Valley to purchase an 860 acre of land on a basaltic mesa and began the construction of Arcosanti. Living in Arcosanti. Arcosanti is not a particularly cozy place to live, and Solari intended it as such. During the early years, the students and volunteers lived in tents and 8x8 concrete cubes, exerting physically demanding labor in construction and agriculture. In Arcosanti as an urban laboratory, Solari noted as a postscript that Arcosanti is not so much a place for the self-expression of young people, but a place for the self-discipline and commitment of such persons within a different structure of habitat. In the 1970s, the counterculture movement drew many to the desert, but a subset of those looking for a drug-friendly party scene were turned away or left on their own accord when they learned there was serious work to be done. In 1970, the New York Times reported that Solari does not intend to harmonize his structure and its surroundings, either aesthetically or functionally. Originally, Arcosanti was designed to be a 20-story rectangular structure made out of concrete, which would have been a marked departure from the prevailing styles of the region that tended to lie low and close to the ground to leave the mountainous landscape unspoiled. Some neighborhoods, like Paradise Valley, has all utilities in a subterranean level. The design also employed the circle as a frequent motif. It is said that Solari was fond of circles, as they symbolize the sun and the moon. The circular cutouts are omnipresent in walls, entryways, and windows. It's in the production studios, which lie under enormous apses, semicircular domes. Every inch of Arcosanti was built by the hands of Solari's students and volunteers, none of whom were paid. Apartment units were built alongside multi-use common spaces like a gym, a laundry room, and a library that doubles as a free second-hand shop. Greenhouses and food forests, composed of naturally layered edible crops that utilize fewer external inputs like fertilizers and herbicides, were constructed with the intention of feeding the residents. Today, Arcosanti remains only 5% completed, with 40-some residents dwelling on its grounds. Sue Kirsch, the archives manager, who has been living on and off the site since 1978, told me that the largest number of residents might have been around 80 people. The greenhouses and food forests don't produce enough food to feed all the residents, which is partially due to the fact that there aren't enough people to cultivate the crops. So they are obliged to make the 45-minute trek to Prescott, the nearest town, to stock up on groceries. The low occupancy rate makes the living grounds eerily quiet. So quiet, in fact, that most of the time the only sound you hear are your own footsteps shuffling across the concrete floor. When there's a breeze, the bronze bells that hang from trees ring through the hot, hollow air. The silence is only broken by the periodic firing of the furnace in the bronze foundry and the occasional bursts of visitors traversing the grounds in a tour group. The tour, and an overnight stay, is the only way for the general public to see the grounds of Arcosanti. The bronze foundry and the ceramic studio are active working environments and are used by residents who produce bronze bells and various ceramic wares. The foundry and the studio are at a stone's throw from the residential units, and Arcomart, a former store turned bar with phosphorescent interiors and refrigerated beers. This means that residents at Arcosanti live, work, and socialize with each other in close proximity. Even with only 40 residents, this arrangement requires intense social connectivity that is more or less constant, and that comes with its pros and cons. The peculiar sense of urban loneliness is almost vanquished at Arco Santi, but this comes at the expense of personal privacy. Social drama, conflict, and gossip are inevitable. Maybe the pros and the cons are supposed to even out, Taylor Morgan, the education manager at Arco Santi, told me. Maybe there shouldn't be an off switch to being around others. The social connections made at Arco Santi seem to be incredibly resilient and long-lasting. Ivan Fritz and Jen Thornton, colleagues at the Cosanti Foundation and Partners in Life, still keep in touch with the friends they made on the site in the early 2000s, even though all of them had now left and dispersed across the country. They sort of become your family, Jen told me, even the ones you don't get along with so well. It's kind of like that crazy uncle you meet at the family gathering during Christmas. However, the idea of constant social connections did not enthuse Solari. By many accounts, he was a private, reclusive person who did not interact with his students and volunteers beyond the instructional realm. Instead, he devoted his energies to writing and sketching, long-distance swimming and jogging, and carving thousands of styrofoam models by hand. A complicated legacy. Paolo Solari passed away at Cosanti in 2013. 4 years after his death, his second daughter, Daniela Solari, published an essay claiming that her father sexually abused her and eventually tried to rape her when she was 17 years old. The Cosanti Foundation, which oversees Cosanti, Arco Santi, and Solari's works, has grappled with ways to come into terms with this development. Before they could come up with a sustainable way forward, COVID-19 triggered an exodus of residents from Arco Santi. The question is an existential one. Can the shortcomings of the artist be separated from the legacy of their work? In 2018, the Cosanti Foundation put forth a statement that the public should distinguish the work from the man, celebrate his ideas by using them to make a better world, and acknowledge, again, that to support great ideas is not to condone the conduct of their creator. But Daniela argued that the failure of her father and the standstill of Arco Santi are intertwined. I believe that the same hubris and isolation that contributed to my abuse also made him, and some of his coterie, incapable of sustained engagement with the intellectual and artistic worlds they felt neglected by, she told The Guardian. Perhaps the artificial, collective isolation of Arco Santi that prevents its broader appeal. Instead of improving the pre-existing ways of urban life, it sought to build a completely separate alternative, an act that was no doubt partly fueled by Solari's egoism. More sustainable and socially connected living is possible within the larger urban fabric. Just 70 miles south in Scottsdale, examples of such exist. David Hovey and his firm, Optima, design LEED-certified buildings with innovative, energy-efficient features that irrigate its abundance of lush plant life and minimize the presence of automobiles. At the Cattle Track Arts compound, artists live and work together, nourishing a rich, familial bond with one another. At Anticus, a downtown Scottsdale art gallery, that functions as a multi-use space, events like wine tastings and readings bring the local community together. At ArcoMart, surrounded by glow-in-the-dark paints and holding a sweaty beer, I spoke to Jen about New York City, where many residential buildings come with third spaces, a communal space that is distinct from the home or work, like rooftops, gyms, and co-working areas that allow opportunities to congregate and connect. My father took the lead in organizing weekly rooftop gatherings for residents, she said. That would be an opportunity for them to socialize and get to know each other and cultivate the kind of community that is similar to this. Still, there is an unparalleled sense of raw beauty that can only be found in the high desert. The sun sets early on Arco Santi grounds, and when I returned to my suite, the inky night sky was scattered with bright, glistening stars. The Big Dipper was the clearest that I've ever seen it, and looking up, I wondered if the frenetic pace of urban life made us lose things that we weren't even aware of losing. When had been the last time I felt the absence of stars? And so I knew
that even without answers to the larger questions, the Big Dipper, sparkling like gemstones, would be reason enough to come back to the desert. People are happier in a walkable neighborhood, the U.S. community that banned cars. A new housing development outside Phoenix is looking towards European cities for inspiration and shuttling out the cars. So far, residents love it. By Oliver Millman, published October 11, 2023. If you were to imagine the first car-free neighborhood built from scratch in the modern U.S., it would be difficult to conceive such a thing sprouting from the environs of Phoenix, Arizona. A sprawling concrete incursion into a brutal desert environment that is sometimes derided for the least sustainable city in the country. But it is here that such a neighborhood, called cul-de-sac, has taken root. On a 17-acre site that once contained a car body shop and some largely derelict buildings, an unusual experiment has emerged that invites Americans to live in a way that is rare outside of fleeting experiences of college, Disneyland, or trips to Europe. A walkable, human-scale community devoid of cars. Cul-de-sac ushered in its first 36 residents earlier this year and will eventually house around 1,000 people when the full 760 units arranged into 2- and 3-story buildings are completed by 2025. In an almost startling departure from the U.S. norm, residents are provided no parking for cars and are encouraged to get rid of them. The apartments are also mixed in with amenities such as a grocery store, restaurant, yoga studio, and bicycle shop that are usually separated from housing by strict city zoning laws. Neighborhoods of this ilk can be found in cities such as New York City and San Francisco, but are often prohibitively expensive due to their allure, as well as stiff opposition to new apartment developments. The $170 million cul-de-sac project shows we can build walkable neighborhoods successfully in the U.S. in the 2020s, according to Ryan Johnson, the 40-year-old who co-founded the company with Jeff Behrens, a former McKinsey consultant. Johnson has the mien of a tech founder, with his company logo t-shirt and fashionable glasses, and was part of the founding team of Open Door, an online real estate business. But his enthusiasm for car-free living was born, he said, from living and traveling in countries such as Hungary, Japan, and South Africa. Originally from the classically sprawly part of Phoenix, Johnson once had an SUV that has been car-free for 13 years. Instead, he has a collection of more than 60 e-bikes, although he said he has stopped acquiring them as he is running out of storage space. Today, in the U.S., we only build two kinds of housing, single-family homes that are lonely and have a painful commute, or we build these mid-rise projects with double-loaded corridors and people mostly just walk to their car, and that makes people no fewer of their neighbors, said Johnson. We look back nostalgically at college because it's the only time most people have lived in a walkable neighborhood. People are happier and healthier, and even wealthier, when they're living in a walkable neighborhood. Cul-de-sac is not only different in substance, but also in style. The development's buildings are a Mediterranean sugar cube white, accented with ochre, and are clustered together intimately to create inviting courtyards for social gatherings and paved, not asphalt, paseos, a word used in Spanish-speaking parts of the U.S. Southwest to denote plazas or walkways for strolling. Importantly, such an arrangement provides relieving shade from the scorching sun. Temperatures in these walkways have been measured at 90 degrees Fahrenheit or 32 degrees Celsius, on days when the pavement outside cul-de-sac is 120 degrees Fahrenheit, or 48 degrees Celsius, the developer claims. The architects call the structures fabric buildings that form shared public realm, rather than charmless utilitarian boxes situated next to a huge, baking car park. It's positively European, somewhere between Mykonos and Ibiza, said Jeff Speck, a city planner and urban designer who took a tour of cul-de-sac earlier this year. It is amazing how much the urbanism improves, both in terms of experience and efficiency, when you don't need to store automobiles. There is a small car park, although only for visitors. Some disgorged by Waymo, the fleet of Google-owned driverless taxis that eerily cruise around Phoenix with their large cameras and disembodied voices to reassure passengers. To calm any nerves about making the leap to being car-free, Cul-de-sac has struck deals to offer money off Lyft, the ride-sharing service, and free trips on the light rail that runs past the buildings, as well as on-site electric scooters. The first 200 residents to move in will be getting e-bikes, too. Such a place is an oddity, Speck points out, because of a car-centric ethos that permeates U.S. culture and city planning. Over the past century, huge highways have been plowed through the heart of the U.S. cities, obliterating and dislocating communities, disproportionately those of color, leaving behind a stew of air pollution. These roads have primarily served a sprawling suburbia, comprised almost entirely of single-family homes, with spacious backyards, where car driving is often the only option to get anywhere. This car dependence has been reinforced by zoning laws that not only separate residential from commercial developments, but require copious parking spots added for every new construction. The result is a nation in which we are all ruthlessly separated from most of our daily needs, and also from each other, Speck said. Cul-de-sac can be seen, then, as not only a model for more climate-friendly housing. Transportation is the U.S. largest source of planet-heating emissions, and studies have shown suburban sprawl fuels more of the pollution causing the climate crisis. But as a way of somehow stitching back together communities that have become physically, socially, and politically riven, lacking a third place to congregate other than dislocated homes and workplaces. Cul-de-sac residents have this shared thing of living without a car, and can have the sort of chance encounters that foster social cohesion, according to Johnson, who himself lives in one of the area apartments. When we started, people said, "What are you doing? You're not going to get permission to build that. The demand's not going to be there." He said, "And instead, we got unanimous approval, and there's a lot of demand, and it's open. Residents love it." Vanessa Fox, a 32-year-old who moved into cul-de-sac with her husky dog in May, had always wanted to live in a walkable place, only to find such options unaffordable. For her, cul-de-sac provided a sense of community without having to rely on a car every time she left her apartment. "For some, cars equal freedom, but for me, it's a restriction," she said. "Freedom is being able to just simply walk out and access places." Beck said that he expects closer relationships to form among residents. "We will soon have cul-de-sac babies," he predicted. Fox admits, though, that some of her family and friends consider her decision to go car-free to be somewhat of an oddity. The New York subway and railroad tycoons of yore may have found international fame, but in the U.S., the car now reigns supreme. Around 9 in 10 Americans own a car, with only a tenth of people using public transport, which is typically underfunded and has suffered badly since the COVID pandemic, on even a weekly basis. Even Joe Biden's administration, which has talked of reconnecting communities and acting on climate change, is enthusiastically pushing hundreds of billion dollars to building new highways. Driving to places is so established as a basic norm, a deviation from it can seem not only strange, as evidenced by a lack of pedestrian infrastructure that has contributed to a surge in people dying from being hit by cars in recent years, but even somewhat sinister. People walking late at night, particularly if they are Black, are regularly accosted by police. In June, the city of Kaplan, Louisiana, even introduced a curfew for people walking or riding bikes, but not for car drivers. If neighborhoods like cul-de-sac are to become more commonplace, then cities will not only have to alter their planning codes, but there will also be a cultural switch from the ideal of a large suburban home with an enormous car in the driveway. Some U.S. billionaires have dreams of creating new utopian cities that have such elements, although urban planning experts point out that it would be better for the environment if existing cities just became denser and less car-centric. Johnson, who said he is planning to bring the cul-de-sac concept to other cities, is upbeat about this. This is something that the majority of the U.S. wants, so they can work all over the country, he said. We have heard from cities and residents all over the country. They want more of this, and this is something we want to build more of. Every trend begins with a one-off, Beck said. True proliferation will be dependent upon our cities improving their transit and micromobility systems. But for those cities that offer a decent alternative to driving, there is a great fit immediately. Government officials should be asking themselves whether their cities are cul-de-sac ready. This is Rebecca Naldo, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading for Are We There Yet? A quirky travel guide to the Southwest and beyond.
On the road again. Just can't wait to get on the road again.
If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left-click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Then, under Programming Links, left-click on On-Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.